Thank you so much for that, Rebecca. It was truly inspiring. I'm going to talk about books. I'm 12 years old, and I'm writing with a ballpoint pen in a spiral-bound notebook. I'm very earnest. My handwriting has some of the loopy excesses that girls use to decorate their letters, particularly the majuscules. But for the most part, the neat lines of writing just come, almost without corrections or change, in page after page of manuscript. I'm writing a book. In my mind's eye, the story is already a bound, finished, illustrated, hard-bound copy of a book. It looks like the volumes in the Louisa May Alcott series, Little Women, Little Men, Joe's Boys. It has hard covers and it has illustrations. A year later, the book I imagined myself writing would have thin tissue paper pages and small type, like the everyman modern classics in which the works of Jane Austen, the Brontes, and Thackeray were issued. I had become a more serious writer. But writing only had cultural authority if it was in the book format. The destiny of any composition was to end up as a book. The destiny of formats. This was the 1960s. It was the period of pop culture and stylishly witty work. I was writing novels. I was writing 19th century novels. I wrote the kind of books that promised to stick with you if you elected to read them. These were books that had length, and they had depth, and they had breadth. I had no taste at that early adolescent age for the spare compositional formats of modern novels, with their thick paper stock and their blunt statements, short sentences. 5 years later, I'm smitten by a long-haired vegetarian boy. I wrote a book as an act of courtship. It's a unique book. It's drawn with India ink, watercolored. I delivered it anonymously through the mail. It's a book of affection. It's a book of seduction. It's a book of shyness, social ineptitude. And it's sent as a bit of attention for the mediated and the distanced relationship. It's sent as a closed book in the hope that it would be opened, in the hope of everything metaphoric about opening when you send a closed book to a boy whose attention you are bidding for. The book is an agent acting on my behalf. It's sent to seduce a pale young poet. I had no luck. To my unhappiness at being spurned, I had to add the remorse at having given away a unique item with its delicate borders and its illustrated vignettes of a boy dancing until he was lost with the wind. So I made another copy for myself, and I solaced myself in possessing this book as a memento. 8 years later, I'm writing a book that's meant to be printed. It's a text that I'm composing in a quiet vacation moment in my parents' house at a dining room table in Philadelphia. I've already taken a class in creative writing and printmaking at the California College of Arts and Crafts with Betsy Davids. And now I'm about to do what I was always meant to do. I'm going to print a book, a real book, a book that's typeset, a book that's bound in signatures, a book that's glued into its covers. This time, the book is going to go into the world. I'm sure of it. It's printed in 13 copies, but one copy I'm going to send to City Lights. That's a real publisher, and I'm going to send them my real book. Now, you have to understand that this book is printed in with stone lithography in Times New Roman, and it has little red velvet covers, and it has a lithographed bat elf on the cover, and it is the most peculiarly perverse book about infantile sexuality that you can possibly imagine. But I sent it to City Lights, the center of hip poetics in the Bay Area. And I got a letter back. I get a letter back from a young poet named Davide, and he said that he and a bunch of people from City Lights were reading my book, and they wanted to know who its author was, who could possibly have written this thing. That was my moment of frisson. I'm about to enter these circles of artistic and literary distinction. I had dreamed of that. I had read about Verlaine and Rimbaud. I knew about Bloomsbury. I knew what my destiny was. This was the social life of books, the very crucible of their conception, as well as the scene of their reception. This was the place where books really mattered, because they circulated among other writers. I went to meet them. Nothing happened. A few years later, I found myself in a world of poets, writers, publishers, and printers, in a community committed to the production of books as the common currency of exchange. I didn't have to find my way into esoteric chambers among aging agoraphobic surrealists. Instead, I was part of the West Coast Print Center, as John McBride knows well, a community enterprise. Books in this context were chapbooks. They were small books of poetry or prose or magazines or journals. They were literary publications in every respect. And guess what? The poet publishers who came in there wanted conventional books. They wanted 8.5, 5.5, 8.5, or 6x9. They wanted the best cut out of the sheet, and they wanted their work put into Garamond or Palatino. That was all we had, along with Times New Roman and Optima. We had 4 film strips. And they wanted it set ragged right, offset printed, and perfect bound. They didn't want any experimental formats. They didn't want any visual or concrete poetry stuff going on. And they wanted the graphics or images restricted to collage or polite line drawings. And they wanted an author photo on the final page or the back cover. These were formulaic books. They were meant to fulfill expectations, and they were meant to legitimate work while interfering with it as little as possible. So I work in that atmosphere among offset presses that are often dripping oil. And beyond and behind, there's a dark room, there's a plate maker, there's light tables that are set up for stripping and opaquing. It's an industry. We're in the poetry industry. We're in the publishing industry. I'm the staff typesetter. I'm exposed to the full range of poetic work, from procedural, contemporary, conceptual pieces to sentimental compositions and tender verses. And in the same period, I go to one reading after another, and I learned to think about writing in and out of the many territory-staking conversations. And I'm influenced at that point by many, many forces, and I conceive of a book. I conceive of a book called From A to Z. It's made from 48 drawers of letterpress type, used once and only once to make a book about the poets, their work, and the social life. But the book is influenced by the work of Alistair Johnston. He's doing research and design and production for a critical bibliography of the Auron Press. I'm fascinated by this. What's a critical bibliography? What is this esoteric project? He has notes. He has lists. He has references. He has an enviable intellectual complexity in this project. I'm jealous. It's obsessive. I love obsession. I want to be that obsessive. So I conceive of a book in imitation of that project, but it's also prompted by the recovered memory of another book, a book called A Picture of Poesis by Rensselaer Lee, That book I found on the top shelves of my parents' library, tucked with other books that were supposed to be unacceptable for children. It was my first exposure to textual scholarship. The Rensselaer Lee book was a reproduction of the original Art Bulletin article, but it had been miniaturized. And so the wave of footnotes that threatened to swallow the text was about 3.5-point size. I'd never seen such a field of paratextual apparatus rising to swallow the original notes. It was my first glimpse of a scholarly book, with all its workings and its intertextual socialities and its reference networks. I stigmatized it by association with its neighbors, Sigmund Freud and Kraft Ebbing. So I thought it was pretty charged in the way that a textual experience could be more thrilling than it might have been. Scholarship, it seemed, was a game of infinite association, complexity, reference, entanglement between structured page, sources of argument, and conversations. This was book as social media, and I recollected it in making my own meta book. Then I'm in Amsterdam. I'm making a book at the height of conceptualism. I've decided I'm going to be an artist, so I'm going to make a really big book. A book that has to be in a museum. I'm printing a series of non-images off an etching plate, and I'm basically writing a book about the dirt and all the things that happen on the surface of the etching plate. It's a very serious book. I'm a very serious artist. And day after day, I go to the atelier and I print whatever has happened to the etching plate the day before. There's a beautiful young woman in the atelier. She wears pink satin pants to come to the atelier to print her etching of a tree. She is drawing a picture of tree bark. There's one of these in every print shop in the world. There is, in every print shop in the world, somebody doing a barking dog and tree bark. There's something about barking, barks, and etching. I think she's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. She looks like Hannah Shigula and by Anna Fassbinder film. I do not have the courage to speak to her. I am printing my serious conceptual book. On the last day, I am so tired. I have been printing this etching day after day after day. I finally turn to her and say, "Your print is beautiful." She looks at me with incredible disdain, and she says, "Yes, what I do is a lot of work." Then I am a junior professor. I get a book contract for my first real book. It's a scholarly book. I learn the mysteries of the multi-stage process of reviews and editing permissions and images and proofs, indexing final proofs in the whole production, the author questionnaire. I find out that a book is a complexly administered process and product. I learned that the text is only partially my own. In fact, the lived experience of finding out about the social production of text is not that pleasant. And the images, they always belong to someone else. I learned firsthand about this whole business of the book as a social production. I redefine what it is for a book to be made. I thought a book was something I printed myself, and there it was. That was a book. No. I find out something else about what it means for a book to be finished. I finally decide that a book is finished when it arrives in a box with a set of identical copies. I get 6 copies. I figure in the per unit value, those copies are worth about $5,000 each, right? Even though it sells for $29.95, I'm trying to sort of like factor this in. Then digital production and pre-press come into play. I work in a CompuGraphic, I work on an Apple II. I use a student ID to go into the Mac lab at Columbia University and typeset my book. But what am I typesetting? I'm using a jagged font to make text blocks. I'm making text blocks. I'm making them in Word. I'm making them in Microsoft Word. Am I writing a book? Am I composing a text? I have a dummy. Of course I have a dummy. I don't know how to think outside of a dummy. I only know how to make a book when it's in front of me, when I can hold it in my hands. So I'm typesetting in this digital way. And I print everything out on a laser printer. And then I sit at a table in my apartment in New York City in the summer. And it's really hot. And I have a sheet of glass and a light bulb underneath it. And I'm pasting up the book. I don't even have a waxer. I'm using a glue stick. It's so pathetic. And it's so hot. I have a fan and I'm sweating. And the air is gray and thick in the way that it can only be in New York City in the summer. But the book, what is the book? The book will only appear after a good deal of stripping and plate making and printing done by Brad Freeman. And I think, what is a book? And yet I've written Simulant Portrait as a book, as a meta book, a book that uses paratextual apparatuses, that uses notes and annotation devices and structures and format features. It organizes its fictional tale across the full space of a table of contents, a preface and introduction, chapters whose relationship to each other as texts makes them take their place in the physical and spatial order of the book. I have thought of this from the very beginning as a book. I have composed not a single line, a single word, a single page without seeing where it fits in the book. So I continue to make books produced by any number of means. I can't learn actually to ever think in digital terms. The imprint of the book form is too strong. I make a tiny mock-up sometimes and use it to guide my writing. Composition is ordered from the start by the regimes and decorums of bookness. I can't think outside its form or its derivatives, the page, the sheet, the pamphlet. I don't have the capacity to think in terms of electronic palimpsests and spatial illusions. My compositional disposition is literal. It's physical. I think writing in and as books. And now, I don't tweet. I don't make those short, pithy comments that are meant to be followed as quick as they appear. Nor do I have a blog, which seems to run like some sad flow of unbounded and abject trailing into a thread of unstructured text. I'm fascinated by these new imprints, these new templates for production. I'm interested in how they work with a collaborative, collective voice of the wiki, the anonymity of the web page, the orphans everywhere unauthored, and the ability of the surface text to contain and conceal its editorial history simultaneously. How does it do that exactly? I see that each format does have a specificity. And I can be amused by the games of spell check poetics that are produced on devices. I am interested in the combinatoric composition of a writing app and the pop-up illusions of augmented reality prompted by a QR code on a printed page. I'm interested in all of those things. I do wonder what happens when the boundary conditions of the book dissolve and when writing refreshes itself in real time, incorporating live feeds and event chains into its textual structures. But I know that every book is an argument for or about the book as a form. And books won't be gone until the imprint of their form disappears from the program of the mind, collective and individual, until the image of the iconic book, hard-covered, finite, autonomous in its existence, and capable of moving across time and space, and enduring, until that notion of the work defined by its boundedness, no matter how temporary or illusional, until that strong imprint in the collective and individual mind is gone. Until then, books will not disappear from our existence. Thank you.